Hey, this is Nick, the Upgraded Life Podcast. You are about to witness the strength of coup knowledge. Episode 28 coming at you. I'm going to bring you Joe Coup. Joe Coup is a master storyteller. His belief, and I agree with him, is that the story that we tell ourselves on the inside and the story that we tell ourselves about the world around us completely shapes our experiences as human beings. So if you want to learn more about the story that you've been telling yourself, and if you want to learn more about how to change your story so that you can upgrade your experience in this life, keep this show rolling, put your phone in your pocket, get your earbuds in, and get ready to take a ride with me and Joe Coup. Hello, thanks for tuning in to the Upgraded Life Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nick Sotelo. The Upgraded Life is my personal project where I help people realize and reach their potential. I've been a professional helper for 20 years. Here's what I'm convinced of. The life that you have right now and the life that you want tomorrow is a product of your personal mindset, mission, and movement. Each episode of the Upgraded Life podcast is going to give you something that you can do as soon as the episode is over to upgrade your personal mindset. Your mindset informs your mission. Your mission tells you how to move every single day. And together, that is the upgraded life. All right. Thank you for taking in another episode of the Upgraded Life Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nick Sotelo. And in today's episode, I have the pleasure of having a conversation with Joe Coup. And Joe is a coach, although he doesn't really align with that term. So I'm going to give him the opportunity to correct me. But that's how Joe and I know each other. We both run in the same circles around, you know, people that are in the business of helping other people. And some of these circles that we run in is all about helping us get better at what we do. And that's how I connected with Joe. That's how I, you know, learned to appreciate his style and his method and his process for being authentic and being unreal, first with himself and then for the benefit of others. So Joe, I'm going to throw it over to you. Correct me. Tell me how you would rather prefer to describe who you are and what you do other than a coach.
Look, coaching is such a loaded term, right? Like anytime I'm asked the question, Joe, what is it that you do for a living? And I hate that question because I know that the answer that's most easy to give would be to say that I'm a life coach. And the problem is, anytime somebody says that, all kinds of pictures pop up.
Right.
You're like Tony Robbins. So you scam people for money over the phone. And it's like, but unfortunately, I do fall under the broad category of life coach. But here's, in a perfect world, here's what I would say I actually do. I am an expert in getting people outside of what they think they are. I'm an expert in helping people reorganize themselves in such a way that they take less bullshit from who they think they are, so that they can be who they really are and live in their world, live in their lives more fully, more passionately, more unapologetically, permanently.
Wow. And before we got on here, I said that, you know, one of the things that attracted me to you is your way with words. And there's a great example of that. So, all right. So I'm going to hold you to it. I want you to walk us through some of these phrases.
Come at me, bro.
Right. So one of the books that I have in the works is called Guru Speak. right. Meaning that when you're in the personal development world, you get inundated with what I call guru speak. And I'm not accusing you of guru speak at all. Right. But I just couldn't avoid the opportunity there. Where guru speak is these little snippets, that, you know, when we hear them, they catch our attention, they sound powerful, but then because they are snippets, we don't know really know what to do with it. We don't really know how to unfold it. We don't know how to orient it to us, which is, you know, that's part of the purpose of Guru Speak, is to get you to then to continue to further reach out and you know, join them, whatever that means, and so I have a whole book ready, you know, with about Guru Speak there,
that's so awesome. We need that.
It's not lies, it's not untruths, right? But the missing piece of it is what does that actually mean to me in the here and now? What can I actually practically do with that powerful snippet that you just told me, So the first thing that I heard you say, Joe, is that you help people get outside of themselves. So what does that mean, and what is that process like?
So there's different dimensions to how to look at this. There's a dimension of just psychology, and here we're dealing with your concept of self, your mental concept of self. Okay. And then there's also, if we want to expand that out a little bit more into what it means in the coaching field, we're talking about mindset. We're talking about being deliberate in how you think, why you think, where you think, what you think. Or metacognition is another word for it. All of this has to do with your concept of self or how you've organized yourself. And what I'm here to say is, that's a very tiny box, actually. What most people conceive of as their self is actually a very, very small construct. It's based on memories. It's based on opinions. It's based on words. And this is something that you can blow open. This is something that you can completely reorganize. You are not limited. You are not your thoughts. You are not your emotions. And I take that to a very practical level. I show people how to really reformat the story of their lives. I get people to realize the power of narrative and what happens when you take that power completely into your hands. The ability to shape your life, to live each day as you intend. But you can't do that as that small box person, right? You have to get out of that. You have to be out of your mind. You have to get out of character to start living something real, right? So again, a lot of guru speak there, but we can unpack that.
Right. So part of it sounds like you have to come to the realization that you are living in character.
Yes.
So what does that look like for the average person, that they're living in character? Like what are they doing and what does it look like?
Yeah. Living in character is basically just the default setting of being human, right? We arrive and we have life experiences, most of which happen during our developmental stages, where we don't have language. We don't have the means to create meaning and organize what's happening. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of this stuff gets internalized. And then we develop adaptations to that. We develop our personality based on the environment, based on what we're dealing with when we're kids, based on our childhood experiences. Now, all of that leads to your concept of self. Good or bad doesn't matter. That's not the relevant question here. What we're dealing with is, this is the default setting. This is how most people function without questioning it. Mm-hmm. For most people, there's no reason to question that. It seems to be working. This is just who I am. Mm-hmm. I am my thoughts. I have this opinion. I hate this person. I hate this organization. This is my team. That's not my team. Self. But is it?
Right.
Right. So, you know, that's the concept of self that I'm showing people. It's understanding that, okay, this is the character that you've been playing, but it's a character. Mm-hmm. It can be edited. It can be deleted. It can be changed completely. And you are what remains at the end of that process. You are not the character itself.
Mm-hmm. I'm getting a super strong Neo and Morpheus vibe here.
Good. That's a good analogy. Yeah. Yeah. I sometimes tell people that, you know, I consider the Matrix to be a documentary dressed up as art. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's very strong symbology there about what it means to be the real you versus the programmed you. Mm-hmm.
I used to say people, that came out in 99, so I was just finishing undergraduate college at the time. I used to tell people, like, the Matrix, the first one, basically wrestles with every major problem known to mankind throughout the ages.
I watch that film religiously. I still watch it to this day at least a few times a year. I still see deeper stuff every time.
Well, I'm glad I was, kind of on with that. But like you said, for a lot of people, living in character is very acceptable. Or they don't know any different, right? And so they don't know to ask the question.
Right.
So how does somebody get to that point of what's really going on here? Like, how does somebody get there?
Most of the time, it's when shit happens. It's when things fall apart. And then you realize the methods that you've been using to live your life up to this point may not be enough. Mm-hmm. It's able to get you here and create this type of situation that you've normalized, that you've gotten familiar with. It can get you to this kind of life that you've patterned yourself into. But what happens if you start realizing this isn't enough? This isn't what I want the end to look like for me. Mm-hmm. Your relationships start to feel toxic. You start to hate your job. You start to get resentful. Things start blowing up. You start losing relationship, job, your identity to the external roles that you've gotten familiar with. Okay, now you're in a crisis. And this is the perfect moment for you to ask a deeper question.
Yeah.
Like, why? Mm-hmm. And who the fuck am I? Mm-hmm. What is the point? Mm-hmm. If all I'm going to create is more of this, then what is the point? Why go on?
Yeah.
All right. And those are the questions I wrestled with. Like, a lot of what I do now came out of me facing major depressive disorder and suicidality and long dark night of the soul. And in the grip of these kinds of questions. So for most people, it does take some form of crisis for them to start being willing to ask, okay, what if this isn't everything? Could there be more? Could there actually be something that justifies me going on?
Sure.
And then you have the few people who no longer rely on crisis because they've been through something and they realize that there is more. And that when you start to become proactive about creating crisis in your life so that you can change instead of waiting for crisis to happen to you, well, that's a very different game to play. And that's what I want to shift people into. It's getting ahead of those crises in a way where you're creatively destroying the things that don't serve you. Mm-hmm. And so that you can emerge again as intended instead of as a consequence of things.
Wow. I don't know where to go with all that. I did have a thought though. So I appreciated you talking about, let's not wait for crisis to happen to us, right? We can go and start creating these things for ourselves, which looks like, getting rid of the things that in our life that maybe ultimately don't serve us. Some people figure this out pretty early on, like even in teen years. And so they figure it out that it's a machine, right? Or that they figure out that they are a battery plugged into the Matrix. But they don't know what to do with that. Right. And so unfortunately some people literally just check out. And this is, sometimes when people turn to drugs as like, I know I don't want to do this. I don't want to be part of this machine, but I don't know what else to do. So I'm just going to go down this path of just suppression and distraction and just numbing out to it. And, you know, if I live, I live. If I die, I die. But what's the purpose of it all anyway? Do you see that to be a relevant theme for people?
Yeah, I think Dr. Gabor Mate kind of explains this very well in the concept of counter will and what happens when, you know, we develop and we mature and we get the sense of not being attuned, not being connected, not being listened to, not being validated, not being shown that we have intrinsic value. And then when something starts to tell us what to do and doesn't connect with us first, well, counter will starts to happen. Counter will is the mechanism that we use to protect that most valuable essence of self. It's that core identity. So a counter will is going to come up and say, no, fuck you. You don't know who I am. Mm-hmm. You don't see me. You don't understand me. So I'm not going to listen to you. In fact, I have to fight you now. I have to go opposite of everything you tell me to do as an act of protecting my sense of core self. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, this tends to never get switched off. You know, it's supposed to be just an instant, right? You have that counter will and then you drop it. For most people, we don't learn to drop it. Mm. And then now that becomes a personality. Now you become defiant, rebellious, whatever the terminology becomes. So I think, yeah, there is something to that where, you know, as a mechanism to preserve ourselves, our sense of self, we start to medicate, and we can medicate through drugs, sex, shopping, addiction, crime, risky behavior, whatever it is. I'm agnostic when it comes to what the expressions are. I more look at it as, what is that medicating? What is that responding to? What is that adapting to? What's the environment there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we are, you and I are, you use language that I use both clinically and in when I work with people in a coaching dynamic as well. So I'm curious to see kind of where your roots in philosophy go with this, but you know, organization of experience, the fact that we're meant to be meaning makers, the fact that this true self versus the false self, those are all concepts that I'm been trained in, mentored in, very familiar in terms of schools, grand schools of psychology. You know, we have id, ego, object, and self. I very much find myself aligning with self psychology and the folks that have done the writing and work and the pioneering there. And so, so how do you just, I mean, so this idea of self is there's no one definition and
yeah, good luck.
Yeah. And I like what Michael Singer does with it, with Untethered Soul. Of course, Bradley is the one that pointed me to that book. Right. But you know, his lead in question to that is, you know, hello, is there anybody in there?
Right.
And that thing that said, yes, that's the self.
Mm.
Right. Mm. You know, that's the thing inside you that says, yes, I'm here. Right.
Right.
But that may not be the thing inside you that says you should be scared right now.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So I often refer to that as the characters or the masks. You know, they're the things that arise when we're not here. It's like an automated message that we developed at some point in our lives when we didn't have the answers, when we didn't have a core self developed. Right. And then these things come up. They become automated. They start to happen to a degree where we start having thoughts that we didn't decide to have. And then those thoughts start to create the pattern in which we live our lives. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of people start to assume that that is self. Well, I am what I feel. I am how I'm reacting. I'm angry right now, so this must be me. I'm angry in this moment. Well, in terms of that little box, yeah, that's true, but you're not that little box. Right. So, Yeah, self is a tricky one. Again, because there are so many dimensions you can use to define what the self is, and all of it would be accurate mm-hmm. in the right context.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I don't even know how I would, you know, necessarily define it at this point in time. Although I, you know, I talk about it in terms of trauma and what trauma does to people. And ultimately what, you know, my school of counseling and psychology is called intersubjective systems theory, kind of came alongside of Kohut's self-psychology theory, although they were contemporaries, kind of the original writers. But anyway, not to bore people with in-depth, you know, analysis of psychological theory, but, you know, IST says that what people ultimately need is a cohesive sense of self that can endure past, present, and future. And that when trauma shatters our spheres of selves in the past, in the present, or in the future, or sometimes across all three. And yeah. when you have multiple shatterings is when really become susceptible to things like, you know, like you were talking about, you know, depression and mental illness and, you know, becoming suicidal is because your sense of self is completely obliterated and you literally don't know what's real, what's not, who you are, who you're going to be.
Right. Yeah. It's like your map of meaning. Your method of creating context and meaning and purpose for yourself in relation to existence, to the world, becomes shattered, becomes, you know, we're able to adapt very well. Like a few things, a few blotches here and there, we'll create a personality that helps us cope with it, or we'll find ways to get around it, through it, under it, over it, or we find ways to hide it, suppress it, whatever. But by and large, we can survive a few blemishes, right? But when there's a deep point of impact somewhere in our lives, deep trauma, abuse, things that really knock out our map of meaning, the danger there is, okay, if one thing isn't true, how does that influence the rest of my entire fucking map? Mm-hmm. And so you have things where, let's say a relationship falls apart after 20 years. That sucks. That's going to hurt. But the real pain is going to be, there's going to be that moment where you're going to have to question how much of that was real. How much did I not know? Mm-hmm. How much did I create a reality that wasn't based on fact here? And if this relationship, this person that I dedicated myself to turned out to be this way, what else do I not know? And now suddenly you're in the spiral. Mm-hmm. Right. Who the fuck am I then? Can I love again? Is love real? Mm-hmm. Should I love? Should there be love? If there is no love, if love can't be trusted, why exist? Ooh, right. That's the spiral. And that's very real for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So this speaks to the importance of our map of meaning. This speaks to the importance of really cultivating the awareness of how are you constructing your life right now? How are you constructing yourself? Is yourself based on narratives that are flimsy? Is yourself tied into a localized sense of self that's just based on how you feel and the few relationships you have right now? Or do you have an expanded sense of why you have that self? Expanded awareness of a non-localized, I call it non-localized, mm-hmm. non-localized self, which is a self beyond your current relationships. Mm-hmm. A concept of self beyond self, a concept of self that's metacognitive, that thinks about what you're thinking about.
Right.
Because that's the fucker that remains when your map is blown up. That's the thing you can trust. That's the thing that you can use to pull yourself out, no matter what happens, no matter where you find yourself, no matter what ends up blowing up in your life. Yeah. If you've developed that core, you're going to be fine. You can orient yourself back because that was and always will be your true self. And then there comes the beauty of what happens when you start living from that space all the time.
So a couple of thoughts that I have, and I love this conversation, and so I appreciate you indulging me in it. So we're in this post-industrial revolution era where science is elevated above, or scientism. I want to make a distinction between science and scientism.
Yes.
Scientism is elevated to being the ultimate yardstick, so to speak.
Right.
And that comes at great cost.
Yes.
And one of the things that I think is a unfortunate byproduct of that is we have almost entirely dismissed the stories that used to be told, fairy tales, lores, myths, legends that used to inform us about who we are and what life is about and what this world means and all these things that we've talked about up to this point. And scientism has thrown them out the window, baby with the bathwater, because those things didn't happen. Those are just stories. Those things can't be proven. There's no evidence for that.
Yet, they couldn't be measured by the tools that they like to use to measure things. Yeah.
And so, if they do still exist, they get reduced to things that only children pay attention to, and waste of time and foolishness and all of those things, right? Because they don't necessarily fit the machine, right? They don't fit the need for productivity and cranking out widgets necessarily, right? But
right.
And so that's a thought that I've had. Yeah. When just in general, but for sure you and I were just talking here, and the other thought, I want to get both thoughts out and then we can decide which direction we want to go, is inevitably when I was in graduate school, I had a professor who was the one that introduced me kind of second round into Carl Jung and his work, but he used to say you need to experience a marvelous unraveling of your faith.
Mm.
And if you're lucky, you'll experience it at least two times, if not three times.
Mm.
And then if you haven't experienced, speak to the class, and he had a right way with words too. I hope to get him on the podcast as well. His name is Dr. Steve Bearden. But he said, if you haven't experienced that yet, because a graduate school class of 30 to 40 students is a wide range. He said, just wait, it'll happen. Right?
Yes.
This is kind of part and parcel with the midlife crisis, inevitably life is going to happen, right?
Yeah.
Things are going to happen. Let's not ignore what's going on right now in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, right? I mean, people are woke up to a whole different, what the hell is going on, in my world, right? No matter which side of, that discussion you're on, the reality is things are turned up inside its head, right? So life's going to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
People are going to die. You're going to lose a job. Somebody's going to leave you. That's just life, right?
Yes.
But today's society, in Western society, is about making us comfortable at all costs. Right? So we forestall, or we push off, or we even if we experience crisis, we have access to so many things, so many ways to suppress that, ignore it, not press into it, not learn from it, not have it refine us, right? And that's because our society worships and values comfort above most anything, right? And so your car breaks down, that's okay, tow it to the junkyard and we'll give you easy financing to get a new car, right? Just a simple example is
right.
And again, is that necessarily a bad thing? No, I'm not saying that that the wealth that society is generating for people isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it comes at a cost. And that cost is doing the hard work that's necessary to figure out who you are and what this life is all about. So those are the two thoughts, you know, the fact that we've dismissed myth, lore, legends that used to inform us tremendously, because the scientism says that, you know, they can't be measured with the tools that we value. And our society of comfort really kind of talks us out of doing hard things or seeing hard things that come in our life as an opportunity to learn and grow.
Yeah, for sure. I think I'll quickly speak to the first point of, you know, sometimes when people look at my profile or they look at things I've done or, you know, places where I've spoken, I often talk about story, the power of narrative. Mm-hmm. And usually what people think I'm saying is, oh, so like storytelling, or like you're like a marketer, like you help people tell better stories to sell things, or, you know, but. And that's very indicative of how separated we've become from what narrative actually is, the importance of it. So I'll self-indulge a bit and talk about what narrative is to me. It's the method through which we create meaning and context. And this meaning and context is everything. So when we talk about, or when I talk about story, I'm not talking about, oh, listen to this story. Isn't it interesting? What was the lesson of the story for you? No, I'm talking about how we organize reality. How we organize existence is done through narrative. It's done through an intentional observing of something with the express purpose of answering the question, what is this? That's narrative. That happens all the time. Mm-hmm. It cannot not happen. The question is, are you aware of it happening? How much of the narratives of your life are you accepting blindly? So when we say something like freedom, did you define what that means for you? Do you know what that means? Have you defined it for yourself? Or did you read it in a book? Were you told what it was in school? Mm-hmm. And then did other people pile onto that? That, well, I mean, this should raise a few red flags, right? Because either you're going to actually know what freedom is because you've defined it, because you're exercising narrative in your life. You're observing this. You're answering the question for yourself. What is freedom? What does freedom mean to me? How is it expressed? In what way is it useful? In what way is it harmful? In what way do I intend to live this word?
Sure.
Or, well, if I don't vote for him, then I'm not supporting freedom. Mm-hmm. Very different ways to live life. Mm-hmm. This is the importance of narrative.
Sure. So now I'm going to ask you a question out of pure curiosity, and meaning that no criticism or judgment attached for this. So this is, you know, definitely sounding, you know, postmodern philosophy. And so there's approaching 7 billion people on the planet, right?
Sure.
And so does that mean in your use of the word narrative, does that mean that there's 7 billion narratives that exist?
No, there's more than that.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Right.
But definitely not a master narrative then.
The master narrative is that there is a master narrative, and that's kind of it. Okay. When we try to define, okay, if there's X amount of people on Earth, then does that mean there's X amount of narratives? Well, it's the X amount of people on Earth. It's what they, what narratives they're adopting from other people, what narratives are inherited, what narratives are invented. So it's not something you can pin down to a number, but the master narrative would be that we're all collectively constructing these things. Either we're defining them and exercising agency over them, or we're not. Mm-hmm. And that would be the master narrative that ties that together.
Yeah.
And through this, this is how we're creating the world. Mm-hmm. This is how we're creating the meaning of what things mean when we do things, how we do things, why we do things. This is all related to our map of meaning, which we're all kind of struggling with together.
Right.
And that would be the master narrative,
sure,
if anything.
Yeah, I get that. No, it's the way of no way from Bruce Lee, right?
Yes.
Right.
Right.
Meaning, is there a master narrative? Is the master narrative?
Right.
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 I can get there with that. You know, some people wouldn't. You know what I mean? But I can definitely get there. Right. But that's the criticism of some branches off the school of postmodern philosophy is that, oh, people just get to make up, you know, their own story and it's their truth. And people say that, you know, out of a belief or a clinging to absolute truth. Right. And so, that's the back and forth, you know, the exchange that goes, you know, between, you know, people that ascribe to modern philosophy versus postmodern philosophy. So I was just curious kind of how you would answer that. And I, you know, narrative is the master narrative. I can get there. So appreciate you having that conversation.
It's a sticky one, man, because oftentimes that conversation is not happening in good faith.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not meant for that. I purely asked the question because I was curious.
Yeah.
I figured you had some thought around it. Right. And so, it wasn't meant to be an attack. I'm going to make you
show
you that you were wrong, but that's typically how those exchanges go.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It comes from an entrenched position, which then I would say, okay, well, that's the narrative playing out right here.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in the counseling world, it gets a little bit confused or concerning, you know, especially when you're working, you know, somebody that has enacted a, you know, extreme injustice or violation on somebody else, you know, and then telling them, oh, you get to reauthor the story of you and, you know, your life. And then the concern is that you're going to absolve them from accountability for what they've done. Right. And so that's where the criticism, at least from the realm of counseling, comes to.
Oh yeah. I hear that a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of people that don't like what I do often will have that as a starting point, which I get it. You know, I'm not here to say anyone's perspective is inherently right or wrong. Like, I'm not interested in that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I do hear that a lot when so much of my work is about helping people, in a way, revisit the events and inform new meaning out of those same events. They mistake what I'm saying, and people infer that, oh, that means you're just covering things over, like you're pretending that something that happened to you didn't happen, or, oh, now you're just going to let all the abusers get away and they're not responsible. Again, I think that's another example of having discussions in bad faith.
Mm-hmm.
Not always, but often I think there's some shade of that going on. But I, as much as I understand where that contention comes from, I lean into what happens. It's that moment when I've walked somebody through something and they realize none of the events that have happened have changed. What happened, happened. But what does change is you no longer have to be a victim to the story that you're telling yourself. This doesn't mean what happened is okay. It also doesn't mean that the people that are responsible are no longer responsible. It does mean, though, that you get to create something else out of this. Mm-hmm. Life has just dumped all the shit upon you. What seed will you plant in there?
Mm-hmm.
How will you convert this into nourishment for you? You are not just the trauma and the pain. You are the process unfolding of deciding what does this mean.
Mm-hmm.
You are a narrative in unfolding. And when we kind of rise up, and this comes to stepping out of character, when you realize, okay, there's another level of me that isn't just the person feeling the pain, feeling the hurt, having the thoughts, having the anger, having the resentment. I am also something unfolding in time and space in this life. And I get to decide, okay, what do I decide this means to me? And that's where a lot of change happens in my work. That's mm-hmm. that's when that click happens and a person's no longer traumatized by their own story. Mm-hmm. And they in fact start mm-hmm. to realize the gift that was in it. And again, without changing the facts, without saying suddenly, oh, that was the most perfect thing. And it's okay that that happened to me. No, it's not okay that that happened to you. The fact right. is it wasn't okay that it happened to you, but here's what you're going to grow out of because of that.
Right.
Here's how you're going to convert that. Here's the meaning that you've been able to create out of that. You exercising your narrative mm-hmm. power, your agency. So is that the same as covering up what happened? Is that the same as putting a Band-Aid? Is that the same as forgiving people that abused you? If you have to frame it that way, I'm okay with that. But I'm going to lean into the fact that I've seen people change. I'm going to lean into the fact that this was how I kept myself from committing suicide. Mm-hmm. And that's the spirit in mm-hmm. which I engage this work.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate that. And I was also kind of hearing somebody that has that concern. I mean, they're operating out of their own narrative of right and wrong and what's ethical and what's moral, right? When this happens, this sure. should be the result, right? And so I was just kind of thinking about, well, yeah, that's their narrative at play.
Exactly. States, right? Right. Exactly. There it is. Yeah. Narrative is the meta narrative, yeah. right? Yeah. It's the master narrative.
Yeah. This is a fun conversation. Thanks for, again, I've already said it. Thanks for doing it. And,
pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the phrase that you said really stuck out to me too, about, you know, helping people not be traumatized by their own story. I mean, that's a heavy, heavy statement there.
Yes.
And I would suspect that we all have that potential to be traumatized by our own story. Right. And we all experience that in varying degrees, right? Mm. And this is where, you know, my education, training, and mentoring in trauma kind of goes beyond the typical descriptions and depictions of trauma, meaning, you know, a single instance of being told or shown of being incapable in something when we're little kids can follow us the rest of our lives.
Yeah. Right?
Doesn't have to be an experience of you know, abuse or neglect, but it could simply be, you know, this message that was dropped into us that, you know, took root and it's been there forevermore, you know?
Right.
Right. You know, something as simple as, I don't like to go, you know, boating or water skiing because, you know, I'm not a very good swimmer because somewhere somebody way back when told me, you know, be careful on the water. You're not a good swimmer because your uncle drowned or something like that. Right.
Right.
And yeah. So that could keep, and that's a simple, stupid, you know, example, but you know, that could keep that person from experiencing a whole nother level or realm right. of life just based on something simple that they were told and that they believed.
And it's ingenious. Because if we slow that down, I think it's really interesting. We created this story here, right? Okay, we have this person that was told their uncle drowned. All right. So let's slow that down and break apart what happens to the young person hearing that. They hear that there's a decision. Well, I don't want to drown. That sounds horrible. So don't swim, don't go into the water. Logically, that's true, that's accurate, good. Well done, you've just created a way to protect yourself and make sure that you survive, and awesome. Now the problem becomes we don't learn to update that story. We're not trained, number one, we're not trained in the fact that we've created the story. Number two, we're not trained in the fact that we operate on stories. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then what we often see happen is a personality develops, a personality that says, I don't like the water. People that do water sports are stupid. Mm-hmm. Water's dumb.
Right.
No, I'm a land guy. No, I don't want to go to the beach. Beaches are dumb.
Right.
Pool. Why would I want a pool? That's a waste of money.
Yeah.
And it's going to sound very much like, this is just who I am. I just don't like it. And then if you push the person, suddenly they're going to feel something deep. It's like, I just don't fucking like it. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I just don't. Stop asking me. Okay, now, what is that? Mm-hmm. Right? That's the narrative mm-hmm. at play. That's that original story that says, hey, don't do water because you'll die.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there, thanks for doing that. Thanks for rolling with a, you know, seemingly benign example. But then, you know, you think about that person, you know, male or female, and as they go on and have a family or whatnot, and mm-hmm. maybe their partner, their spouse, their kids are like, hey, let's get a pool. No, mm-hmm. we're not going to have a pool, mm-hmm. right? You know what mm-hmm. I mean?
Exactly.
And then that's where trauma, right. you know, can come in, right? And,
exactly.
Yeah. But
and again, I like that this is a benign example because it allows us to extrapolate a little bit. Mm-hmm. If we do a thought experiment, well, what about something more traumatic?
Right.
And we don't have to discuss that here. But now when you see how a benign story can have such a deep impact, mm-hmm. that allows you to question, wow, what about something heavier?
Sure.
Right.
And I don't know if you're familiar with, you know, like John Eldred's book, Wild at Heart.
I'm not actually.
Yeah.
What is that about?
And so it was popular within, you know, the Christian church about a decade ago, and he's written several books, but he's tapped into Robert Bly. He's a friend of his, and the convention that I think happens on a regular basis in LA on. And I can't remember what it is, but very informed by you know, Jungian theory on what it means to be, you know, human and a person mm-hmm. and whatnot. And, but anyway, the book is about, you know, about how, men carry a father wound, all men. Mm-hmm. Right. And mm-hmm. it's this benign example that we just went through that I think it's overlooked. It's not recognized as, you know, being wounded by my father, right? Because if you had a very caring and loving father who didn't abuse you or who didn't do these, you know, things that we would typically ascribe to as, you know, trauma or damaging or hurtful things, then you can read that book and be like, well, this is a guy talking about, I don't have a father wound, right? But right. It could be something as simple as, hey son, we don't do this, you know, because of this. Okay, you know what I mean? And then you carry
yeah, it could literally just be your father saying, wow, that was a long day at work. I am pooped.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, if you take that on subconsciously, that starts writing your future narrative for everything related to working and how you're supposed to feel after you work. And
yeah.
that ties into money and that ties into identity. Right. And yeah, man. So yeah, that's narrative. That's how deep these things go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
When I was getting more acclimated to you and the work that you do and kind of your descriptors that you have out there, you talk about helping people slay dragons. And so I'm interested in kind of, you know, where do you tap into that symbolism to, you know, make that part of how you describe what you do?
The biggest dragon that we all carry is our shadow. So when I'm talking about, I help people become heroes, what am I referring to there? It's not about being a badass. It's not about crushing it. It's not about anything external. When I refer to hero, I'm referring to a classical definition of hero, which is you start as an average person, and then you go through an ordeal, and that ordeal changes you. Hopefully for the better. And out of that, you go back to where you were different. Again, hopefully for the better. And that's hero. And anybody can be a hero at any point. They just have to choose to. Mm-hmm. They have to make that decision of, okay, I've gotten to this point, and maybe something in my life has collapsed. Maybe something isn't happening. Or maybe I've just gotten to a point where I can no longer accept this as being all there is. And now you reach that decision point of, okay, I'm going to have to do something different. I'm going to have to confront some things that I've been keeping in my shadow. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to choose the pain of going through that instead of medicating it away, instead of turning away, instead of denying it. Mm-hmm. This time I'm going to have to stand and face it. Mm-hmm. It's that Neo moment. If we can bring back the Matrix, it's Neo in that scene in the train station. He's facing off with Agent Smith. And for the first time, he doesn't run. He turns. He decides to face Smith. And that's that initiation, right? So when I talk about slaying dragons, I'm really talking about facing our shadow. And the shadow is going to be all the things we don't want to admit that we have. Mm-hmm. And for very good reason. It's things that we've either been ill-equipped to deal with, things that are too traumatizing in the moment. And so we compartmentalize and we siphon it away from our conscious, and we put it somewhere where it can be contained for a little while. But it's kind of like storing nuclear waste. It's like it's there. It's probably having some background radiation effects on you. Mm-hmm. But by and large, we get away with, you know, stuffing the stuff down until it doesn't work anymore. Until there's a meltdown. Until the safeties start happening where, you know, some crisis emerges in your life and you realize suddenly you can no longer hold all this stuff back anymore. You no longer have the resources to keep all of this stuff hidden. Mm-hmm. And it starts to come out.
Yeah.
Right. Welcome to your breakdown. Mm-hmm. So my intent is to help people navigate this willingly instead of waiting for that crisis moment to happen. Mm-hmm. And to provide safety as a person that has done this kind of work for myself. Mm-hmm. I'm able to facilitate that. And I have a deep friendship now with darkness. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid of it. Mm-hmm. I've spent a lot of time simmering in my own shadow. The approach I took was to not try to fix anything. It was to really just sit there and listen and put my ego aside. And hear what the pain was trying to tell me all these years. Really learn that language, really process, really integrate them. Mm-hmm. And to not be in denial and to tell myself the truth and make it okay. And learn to love facing all of the stuff that made me ashamed, guilty, insecure, all the toxicity that we all have. And if you say you don't have any, you're lying. You're just keeping it in your shadow.
Right.
Fine, good. If it works, great. Yeah. There's going to come a point, though, maybe someday, where that's not going to work so well for you.
Yeah. It's like, right? There's a Carl Jung quote that says, show me a sane man and I'll cure him.
Yeah, there you go. Right. So that's what I mean when I'm talking about hero work. It's not about necessarily doing anything external. Mm-hmm. And it's not about being big or having mega success. It's about, can you face the deepest, darkest part of yourself and not flinch? Can you really look deep? Can you really get to your core and look it in the eye and give it a kiss on the lips? Can you do that? Mm-hmm. And it's okay if the answer is no. That just means, okay, there's some shadow there. Mm-hmm. It's not your enemy. In fact, this is you. Imagine putting a piece of you into a dark cage and then never giving it any food, any nourishment, any light. What do you think that's going to do? Well, that part of you is going to become a demon. It's going to become a monster. It's going to become enraged. It's going to want your attention. It has value. It has something to give to you, but you weren't ready to deal with it. So you put it away. Well, that doesn't make it disappear. In fact, it costs energy to maintain that and keep it there.
And that cage rattles.
It rattles, yeah.
And you drop crumbs and it gets fed anyway.
Right, exactly.
And it does get bigger and stronger.
Right. And then you have two options. You can go into the cage and resolve it, or build better systems on top to manage it, hide it. Or, and you have, if you have relationships, oh shit, well, make sure they don't hear the cage rattle. Mm-hmm. Or if they do, find some way to explain it away or make it their fault. That's even better. Right. Deflect.
I don't hear it. What are you hearing? You're hearing things.
Yeah. And stop projecting your shit on me, man. You're right. So, yeah.
ultimately those systems fail though, right? And that you stack on top of it. I mean, that's the whole point, isn't it?
Ideally they fail. Mm-hmm. Ideally they do. Mm-hmm. But if experience has been indication, people have a remarkable tendency to avoid doing the deep work.
No, I get that. I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess that is the, you know, as you do find yourself in final stages of life, right? And you do have this sense of grief and despair, you know, your system's got you that far with you know, I mean, maybe avoiding the work. Yeah.
Right.
I can see that.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you're going to be operating against your concept of self. Mm-hmm. Right. So it becomes very difficult to navigate because now you're literally arguing with yourself. Mm-hmm. You're arguing with the part of yourself that says, no, but this is what kept us safe. Mm-hmm. This is what worked. Mm-hmm. This is survival. Yeah. Are you sure you want to go in here? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the antivirus that you've trained, right? Every time something happens, the antivirus pops up. Hey, are you sure you want to do this? You click yes. Hey, are you sure you want to do this? You click yes. Eventually it learns that this is your behavior. This is your pattern. Don't interrupt you. Just make it so that you can keep doing this. And that becomes your personality. Mm-hmm. It's agnostic to whether or not these things are good for you or not. Mm-hmm. All that it's doing, it's just a faithful record of what you've been accepting mm-hmm. over a long period of time. So you can't blame that, mm-hmm. right? You can't go back and say, oh, it's my mind doing this to me. No, you did this to you over and over. Mm-hmm. All that this is mirroring that back to you. So it's going to feel intense when you start to change. You're going to be bumping up against all the times you previously said yes to that. Now you're saying no. You're going to have to be as diligent in the beginning, saying no, 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 yes. Oh, I mean, no, 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 yes, no. And you do that long enough, the no becomes your new response. Mm-hmm. This is how you break a character. Mm-hmm. This is how you realize, oh, shoot, I'm actually limitless. I can be anything. It's a matter of taking that agency back. Like how deeply do I want to own myself? How present do I want to be when I make decisions? How much of these decisions do I want to be happening automatically based on my antivirus setup, right? Based on my characters, based on my personality that I've developed all these years. To what extent am I satisfied that they're giving me the best quality of life, the best meaning, the best possible mm-hmm. potential? And if at any point the answer becomes, you know what, they're not doing enough, there's more, I want to change. Well, this is where you slay dragons.
Yeah. I appreciate that. And I'm thinking about, I think it's the Galahad myth, Sir Galahad. And I don't know how much you're familiar with that, in terms of symbolism, but, you know, not to counter what you said, but at times the dragon is external as well. Mm. Meaning that that in our youth, sometimes we were able to do things because of our youthfulness in terms of, you know, muscling a dragon and slaying it. Mm. But as you get older, you don't have the same physical prowess that you do. And then that becomes the trap of, I'm no longer capable. I'm no longer effective anymore because I can't do it in the same way. Mm. And you know, there's a story in there about how, you know, the knights had to figure out a different way to slay the dragon. And some of them would accept that and some of them wouldn't. Right. Mm. And so, and then in the book, I think it was Robert Johnson's book that he's writing about this. This is where, you know, the high school quarterback that was the star that, you know, doesn't end up going to college, doesn't end up, you know, with a pro career, that, you know, is in his hometown and he's a drunkard now and he beats his wife is he's still trying to slay the dragon like he was when he was, you know, 17 years old on the high school, gridiron, and he can't do that anymore. Right. Mm. He was actually only able to do that once in his life. Right. And talk about narrative again, right? Oh, I did this once. I should be able to do it every single time forevermore.
Right. Yeah. I mean, again, it's context. So I can see that context. Mm-hmm. If this was somebody I was having a conversation with, I would challenge them on one point, which is that, yeah, there is that external dragon of wanting the acclaim, the success that you get by being able to do that. But that's there's a deeper dragon. Mm-hmm. There's a dragon that says you have to do these things or you're nothing.
Yes. Yes.
And that's, I find that, yeah. And again, this is not to dismiss the external at all, but I find that when we're willing to go that deep, that's when you're most likely mm-hmm. to break character. Because at that point, you're not just dealing with the external. You're dealing with your entire mm-hmm. concept of self.
Yep.
What does it mean if I never slay that kind of dragon again? What mm-hmm. if, I never do that again? What's left of me? Mm-hmm. And for most of our lives, we'll run away from that question. Mm-hmm. And we'll try to slay the dragon that we can see, mm-hmm. which is, oh, all I have to do is do that thing again. Mm-hmm. Then I'll get my value back. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't beat that. Well, I'll beat something else. Mm-hmm. Right. And we can infer what that means.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I appreciate that. Was a gracious, you know, exactly. You know, that it, when we foist our identity on the external, you know, again, ultimately that's going to fail and it's going to put us right back into who am I?
Yes.
Who am I?
That's the most painful question. When you really want to get honest with it, mm-hmm. it's the most painful question you'll ever wrestle with mm-hmm. because it's going to cost you everything to get the answer. Mm-hmm. In fact, it has to cost you everything. The only way to know who you are is to strip yourself of the things that can be stripped. And that's when you know this is who I am. Mm-hmm. This is the part of me that never changes. This is core. This is me. Day in, day out, no matter who I'm with or what I'm doing, this is the deepest core essence of me.
Are there categories to that, or is it purely an individual thing each and every time?
Well, depending on how deep you want to go, the answer to that would be yes and no. Mm. Right? So it is individual in the sense that all of us will have our unique point of being. But it's also not individual in the sense that pretty much all of us will operate on this spectrum. Most of us will have a localized self. The localized self is our ideas, our identities, our characters, our personalities, the things that arose out of our default settings as we fumbled and stumbled through life. There's also the non-local self. The non-local self is the self that is thinking about what the local self is thinking about. So in that sense, we all have that capacity to step out, to mm-hmm. allow ourselves to face that deeper dragon, which requires, okay, what does it mean? Like for me, one of my issues was for a long time, I hid my ethnicity. I didn't like being Chinese. Mm-hmm. So what did I do? I kept my hair shaved very close. I developed a good diction. I spoke like a well-educated white person, mm-hmm. still here today. Mm-hmm. But that was me slaying a smaller version of the dragon that I could see. Mm-hmm. If only I don't appear Asian, then I'll be okay. Mm-hmm. Then I don't have to feel all the toxic shame and all the abuse and trauma. As long as I can keep that up. And then the minute somebody calls me Asian or makes a Chinese joke or something, ooh, everything just gets flipped in me. But then, oh, no, just turn that down, suppress that. No, they're just stupid. Fuck them. Okay, well, that's me still in character, mm-hmm. right? Until I gave myself permission to ask that question. Okay, who am I? What if I am Chinese? Mm-hmm. Ooh, what would that mean? What am I going to have mm-hmm. to make peace with that? Mm-hmm. What am I going to have to be okay with? I'm going to have to be okay with people doing this to me, right? I'm going to have to make peace with all the penis size jokes. But why did those things affect me so much? Mm-hmm. Why was I so attached to those things not happening around me in order for me to feel okay? That's hero work. Mm-hmm. That's the deeper dragon. Mm-hmm. The only way to do that is when we start to step out of that local self and start to realize, okay, there's a deeper self that transcends all of this, that can survive these labels.
Sure. And fairness isn't a factor there, is it?
In what way do you mean that?
Well, I mean the very personal things that you just shared, that's not fair. You know what I mean? That's not fair for you to have to, I mean, you didn't ask for those things. You didn't ask to be born.
Exactly. Right.
And so some people will kind of, you know, again, use a narrative of I shouldn't have to deal with that. That's not fair. Well, I mean, you're
right. Yeah, I mean, it's not anyone's fault. Yeah. But it is your responsibility. And responsibility isn't an implication of guilt. It's your response mm-hmm. ability. It's your ability to respond to this.
Love it.
Right?
Yeah.
So you have the ability to respond to this. If you don't exercise this ability, then you have no say in how it's going to shape you until you take your ability to respond to this, right? So in that way, we are all responsible for what we're carrying. This doesn't mean that we asked for it or that we deserve it. In fact, I would say we don't deserve these things, which is why we should be taking responsibility. Mm-hmm. And that's how I approach that.
I love that. I love that breakdown of that word responsibility. That was very, very helpful. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Well, Joe, we definitely could keep doing this. It seems like we can go on for quite a while.
I can talk for hours, and I have. So this is your platform. You let me know when I've said enough.
Yeah. Appreciate it. So the question that I'm gonna force you into now, because this is what I do with all my guests, is, you know, respond to that phrase or term, mindset. What does that mean to you if you use it or have any kind of use for that for that phrase?
So this is where it might get a bit contentious. So mindset is helpful in addressing a lot of what I call the localized, and we've talked about localized self on this program a bit. So localized self is matters having to do with your sense of self, your identity, the way that you think, the thoughts, your emotions. Mindset then would be your ability to start to edit these things, start to have control of these things, start to decide what you want to think instead of having your thoughts think you. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the shift that mindset allows. It gives you that step of metacognition is part of it, but it's the concept of you now taking responsibility for what you're thinking before you think it. You taking responsibility for what you're choosing to make your behavior pattern mm-hmm. become. Mm-hmm. Instead of relying on the pattern or blaming the pattern or justifying the patterns or saying, oh, it's just, this is just who I am. This is how I think. Yes, until you decide that's no longer the case. Mm-hmm. And that's this is where I see a mindset coming in. The majority of my work is no longer about mindset, not because I don't think it's important. It's that I've shifted my work to what happens after mindset. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so sometimes people will misread things I post when I say something like, I recently made a post about I don't teach people meditation, and yeah, I got so much hate. I knew that was coming, but it was something I needed to say. But I'm not saying don't meditate. I'm not saying don't practice mindset. Like, please do. But know that there's more after that. Mm-hmm. That mindset alone isn't going to help you slay that deep dragon. Mm-hmm. Meditation alone isn't going to help you get to that decision point of what happens if I'm not myself? What happens if the self I've been living is no longer the self that I want mm-hmm. to be? What am I going to have to make peace with? What struggle is there in that for me? Meditation mm-hmm. itself won't help you navigate that. But they can help get you there.
Sure. They're right. Part of the process, but they're not the process itself.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that And in some of these things, again, maybe this is another example of guru speak as well, right? Where, mm. you know, in my world, you know, mindfulness in terms of, you know, clinical counseling has, you know, a lot of momentum around it. And, you know, but when I've researched, you know, the people that really originated, you know, the concepts of mindset, you know, going back to like, you know, Buddhism and Thich Nhat Hanh and whatnot, mm. Their purpose for mindfulness is self-awareness.
Yes.
Right. It is to use your language to help us discover if we're in character or not.
Yeah.
Right. But what, again, I think this is a product again of scientism and the society of comfort is, oh, we want to use mindfulness to, you know, help us get along better with other people. Right.
Sure.
You know, sure. Which it's not a bad thing, but it's not
a bad thing.
Yeah.
It's just not, that's not the only application. That's right. Not the only scale to which.
Right.
So something I'll say is like, meditation doesn't just have to be what you do for 20 minutes a day in the morning or in the evening. Because I would question what happens for the remaining 23 hours of your day.
Right.
Are you meditating then? Uh-huh. Meditation is something that occurs as a state. Yeah. Like I know I still meditate, but I also meditate right now. I'm meditating mm-hmm. right now. I'm in a state of being hyper aware of what I'm saying, how I'm saying it, who I'm saying it as. I'm paying attention to, do I want to sound smart? Do I mm-hmm. want to impress Nick? I'm on his show. Oh, how do I look? Oh, I should say this. Oh, like, is that going on? Right? That's meditation. Mm-hmm. So I would say that there's that deeper sense of application here that tends to be missed, mm-hmm. right? When we start to think of, you know, NLP or meditation or these tools that help a lot with mindset and rezoning and reframing, they're great, but the question is how much of it is being applied in the moments where it matters the most, which is right here, right now, when you're awake, when you're actually in the active engagement of your life mm-hmm. in this moment. Are you aware of your breathing right now, or have you habitualized, I only go there when I meditate, mm-hmm. I'm only doing this when I have the 20 minutes? Again, it's better than not having it, but I would caution against habitualizing that as being the only place in which you attain that deeper sense of self, mm-hmm. that non-localized self is always here, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. And again, I think the people that are the true masters of meditation, they talk about meditation through the daily routines that we have, like walking, yes, meditation, meditating while we eat, you know, all those, yes, all those things. But you're right. We have, right, we have reduced it to, here's this thing that I do because I read it in a an article online about the benefits of meditation. Right?
And the thing is, like, you know, it does work. It's, yeah, great.
Yeah.
It's kind of like what happens when marketers, again, not all, but marketers that are very narrow in what they do, when marketers get a hold of something that works, it becomes all about, how do I use this? How do I exploit this? How do I use this as a shortcut to get more out of life? How do I use this to squeeze more value out of things? Oh, if I learn NLP, I'll learn how to manipulate people. I'll learn how to sell things to people and convince people and be more engaging and not have to feel my shame. And I can use NLP to reprogram myself and not have fear. And okay, yes, that's kind of like you creating a better character. You're not yet at the point of questioning, why have a character?
I had the vision of Eddie Haskell when you said that, right? From Leave It to
Beaver. Yeah, it's like, yeah, like, you know. So again, this is not an argument of don't use these things for those purposes. You can, but there's a lot more to that application.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're forcing me to be, reflective on my own, the extent that I'm relying on character as well. Right. Mm. And, you know, my process right now in working with people and the way I coach people is to break it down into, you know, mindset, mission, and movement. And where I'm being cognizant of character there is I completely agree with you that, ultimately, we have to deal with ourselves and we have to deal with our shadow.
Right.
But I don't always speak to that as bluntly as you do out of this, of this fear or concern, that I'm going to be confusing the people or just, or, you know, they're not going to like that.
Look, man, like I don't recommend what I do to everybody. Like it takes a certain level of preparation and willingness to engage in the kind of work that I do.
Right.
So that's why it's like, I'm not saying people that are doing meditation or NLP or mentorship or mindset work are doing anything wrong. Mm-hmm. That's exactly appropriate for what people need at that level. What I'm saying is there may come a point where after that, they then become prepared. Mm-hmm. Once you start realizing, well, there are such things as characters. Mm-hmm. There are those moments where I realize I've been playing these characters. Mm-hmm. And now if I want to change that, I can't just become a better character. Sure. I'm going to have to go deeper here. Mm-hmm. And that's where I do my work, or the work that I spend most of my time engaging in at the moment. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like, I don't think anybody should right off the bat come right out and say, okay, let's kill your demon. like that's not appropriate. Mm-hmm. It's more, okay, well, where are you on the spectrum of what you're dealing with right now?
Yeah.
And look, there's nothing wrong with characters. In fact, it's about becoming aware and mindful of what characters you're deciding to create. What purpose are they intended to serve? Characters are helpful. Characters are just personalities. They're just automated things that are in alignment with who you've been. So it's useful to have characters. It's useful to still think about, how can I create a better mindset? It's useful when you're handling this in a mature, responsible way. It's great to have characters.
Yeah.
The deep work is about understanding, how did those characters generate, how many of those characters currently are servicing older stories,
right?
And if you need to shift, if you're ready to shift, that would be a conversation to have at that time.
And I think that the way that I get there with people is, you know, mindset, mission, and movement. But if you still aren't, you know, experiencing the gains right? Mm. You go back and okay, let's look at this again, right? You know, recently I was working with somebody around their affirmations, because I kind of have, you know, my own bent on that.
Yeah.
And you know, so I'll do an affirmation spot check every once in a while, you know, and say, hey, let's look at your affirmations. And what I noticed was this person was missing affirmations in two areas of their life that I knew that they were really, really, really struggling with. You know, and so I kind of just put that out there, like, hey, you don't have any affirmations about this part of your life.
Yeah.
And there was a battle that ensued between us around that.
Yeah.
Like don't make me put that in my affirmations, because I don't know what to do with it. There's nothing else that I can do. This is always the way. Okay.
Right. Yeah. There it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hello, narrative.
Yeah, exactly. Hello, dragon. Hello, caged demon. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Right.
So again, thanks for being gracious for me in working to a similar spot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another thought that I had, and we'll wrap up here, is I was listening to John Maxwell speak last summer. I was at a convention and he talked about the big picture getting much bigger the closer we get to it, right? And so he talked about, like, you know, imagine you're in the ocean in a boat, and the big picture is way out there, right?
Right.
You're at least believing or sold on the concept that there's a big picture out there for you, right? So you get in the boat, and you start rowing. My camera's off here. You start rowing to it, right? But when you're way out here, it looks like a speck,
right?
But as you get closer and closer to it, it's way bigger than what you've ever imagined.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
And I just have been picturing that a lot, not just in this conversation, but just in general, right? So when you start doing the work, like you're inviting people to do the work, be ready.
Yes. Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of times people that have worked with me for a while, they'll look back and they suddenly don't recognize who they were when they first started.
Yeah.
That's how much can change. Yeah. And it's vast. But, you know, on our first conversations during the, you know, discovery calls, you know, if I were to say to them, hey, by the end of this, this is what's going to happen in your life, and this is how things are going to look, they're just going to hang up.
Right.
They're going to be like, fuck you, dude. Like, don't lie to me.
Right.
Right. But, you know, people shift in ways that I can't even predict. Sure. That's how deep this stuff can go.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So discovery call. So how do people, I mean, you know, I do this podcast, you know, for people like you to be able to kind of, again, share your message to the world.
Yeah.
And I believe that there's going to be people that are going to hear this and they're going to want to connect with you. So how do they find you, Joe?
So I'm very specific about how people connect with me. The best thing to do is find me on Facebook and send me a message. I don't have a funnel. I don't have a marketing website. I decided to do that very deliberately. Mm-hmm. So the best way for people to connect with me is to actually connect with me, find me on Facebook. Let's talk, let's have a discussion, and let's see if I might be able to help. And if I can't, I'll let you know.
Sure.
Right.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And then so somebody finds you on Facebook, they send you a message, you have dialogue. Are we going to get on a phone call, or what's the next step there?
Right. If it makes sense for us to, we'll hop on a call and we'll just keep going deeper until we get to a point where we both agree, okay, it makes sense. Let's work deeper and let's talk about what would that look like in a coaching package. Mm-hmm. Everything that I do is bespoke. I don't have a cookie cutter like, it's this package and it's this much. Mm-hmm. Like I work with you, the individual. So that's why I don't have like just click this buy now button. Not saying that's not good. Okay. Yeah. Don't hear what I'm not saying.
Sure. Yeah. But for you though,
this is how I operate.
You've made, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I'll be sure to, you know, put that link to your Facebook in my show notes.
Awesome.
My last question for you is that, so you did a great job of describing mindset, right? Mindset is that conscious discipline that you need to really kind of unprogram, you know, the unhelpful program that we have.
Right.
So what I like to do for folks that are listening, as soon as this podcast is done and they press stop, what is something that you would encourage them? And I'm going to loop this back into, you know, your language and your process.
Sure.
If somebody's curious about the extent that they're in character, what can they do to start assessing that in their own life?
The easiest thing to do is to practice being still. And you'll find that, by and large, this will be impossible. The goal is not to actually be still. The goal is to pay attention to what comes up when you're still. And usually it's going to be the stuff in your shadow, assuming that you haven't done a lot of shadow work. It's that moment where you're by yourself and you're making that intentional decision to just, I'm going to be still. I'm here. I'm not doing anything. And I'm seeing the dust in the air. And then eventually you're going to be like, why am I doing this? I've got better things to do. Oh, I can't believe this person is still doing that. There you go. The moment you stop trying to not be something, or the moment you stop trying to be something, this is where you start to see how much has actually been running in the background the entire time that you've not been addressing, and does have an influence on your life, but you haven't given yourself permission to look at it. Those are the footprints. Those are the thumbprints of your characters at work, of your shadows at work, at play in your life when you're not present. And that's the first thing, the easiest thing to do. This should leave you feeling uncomfortable. If you've done this correctly, you should come away with a sense of, what am I? Why can I not be still? Why am I so charged up? Why is there so much of the stuff in me? Perfect. That's where you start.
Great. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. And very practical, and anybody willing to do the work can derive huge benefit from that. And if they do do that exercise, do that activity, whatever we want to call it, and then they decide to connect with you, they're going to have a head start already.
Exactly. Yeah. Tell me what came up. Yeah. What was the monster that came up when you stopped running?
Absolutely. Joe, I appreciate you. And thank you so much for taking time for me to come on the show. I know that there are going to be people that are going to have their lives changed, you know, because of our conversation. And that's what, for me, that's what it's all about. Right. And so,
yeah, for sure.
You know, I believe everybody has a message that needs to be heard far and wide. I know that about you. I knew that about you. So again, thank you for coming on and sharing that message.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Joe Koo talking to me. I really enjoyed that conversation. I hope you did too. I hope you learned something about yourself, your story, and the experience that you're having in this world. Joe's take on all this is raw and real, and I know you got a sense of that. And I'm going to encourage you to implement his strategy that he shared with us, and that is spend time being still. Get a timer. Get a 5-minute timer. And just commit to being still for 5 minutes. And like you said, you can't actually be still, but the things that are going to come up are the things that make up the fuel in your shadow. Shadow is that side of us that we don't want to admit that's there. Sometimes we aren't even aware that it exists. We all have a shadow side. Being still is one way to boost your awareness of what's in that part of you that you don't want to admit that's there. That's a powerful technique. I'd encourage you to try it today. Be still for 5 minutes. Thanks to Joe Koo for putting that out to us. As always, if you want to know more about Joe Koo, if you want to see any of the links that we talked about in the show, go over to my website. You're going to see all that info tucked neatly in the show notes. My website is www.nicksotelo.com/TUL podcast, the Upgraded Life Podcast. While you're over at my website, don't forget to check out the three opportunity buttons at the very top. they are scheduling a time with me. I'll give you a free 30-minute strategy session. Checking out CBD products from Nature's Ultra. And then also, if you're looking to create an additional stream of income, I can help you out with that too. This takes 20 minutes of your time. Click on the button that says Income Boost. Give me your name and email, and I'll send you a presentation. Thank you again so much for listening to my show, the Upgraded Life Podcast. If you got something out of Keith Weber's information, his info on kettlebells and mindset, and just his overall story, let me know by going over to Apple Podcasts, leave me a 5-star review, and that will tell me that you enjoyed the show. This is Dr. Nick Sotelo, and I'm urging you to do something today to realize and reach your potential, and I'll catch you on the next show.